Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, March 4th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Artificial intelligence is not just writing emails and generating images. It's helping to plan military operations. It's analyzing intelligence, it's identifying targets, and in some parts of the world, it's already guiding drones on the battlefield. Now, a high-profile dispute between the Pentagon and one of America's leading AI companies is raising urgent questions. Who gets to decide how AI gets used in war? The military, private tech companies, Congress. Anthropic, maker of the AI system Claude, refused to allow its technology to be used for mass surveillance of Americans or fully autonomous weapons. The Pentagon wouldn't agree to those restrictions. That deal collapsed, and now the Department of Defense has struck a new agreement with OpenAI. This hour, we'll talk about AI on the battlefield. We'll look at how advanced AI-powered weapons are being used these days, what it means for warfare, with two really smart guests. And our questions of the day for you, friends: should we restrict how AI can be used in war? Why or why not? We'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, please share the video, but also put your comments in the live chat.
And we already have a lot of really interesting comments coming in. Let me read this one from Jeff, who says, "It's war, not a pickup game in the neighborhood gym. Is there really such a thing as rules in war? I say no."
Yeah.
So I'm curious what you think about that. Also, if you just have questions about how AI is being used or could be used in war, you can submit those as well. Studio2@whyy.org. Again, the number is 888-477-9499. We'd love you to pick up the phone.
Yeah. Trio of news stories, Avi.
We'll keep it local first with a trio of local news stories, starting with some continuing turmoil in Quakertown, Bucks County. You know that community has been in the spotlight ever since a student walkout over ICE policies ended in a confrontation with police. Here's the latest. Quakertown School Board last night accepted the resignation of the district's superintendent. Matthew Freeman had been with the district since 2023. In November, the district actually gave him a raise and an extension. However, on February 13th, Freeman went on leave. Of note, that's actually a week before this protest that's got all the attention. So it's a little unclear if his resignation has anything to do with the protest or not. And the board said very little about the superintendent's resignation, according to the Inquirer. There were some oblique remarks about needing a superintendent who was more present and accountable, but that's really all we know so far. Meanwhile, we're still waiting for a lot of answers about that student protest. Five students arrested and charged. The borough's chief of police, who was involved in the confrontation, is now on leave. So one major official has already left, but we don't know the fate of many others.
Yeah, and if you recall, that police chief who's on leave, his name is Scott McElry. He's also the bureau manager. He was seen on the video placing a student in a chokehold during that ICE protest. He was in plain clothes. The borough solicitor has said that he's on workers' compensation leave because he was injured in that, that little kerfuffle there. Other people have been put in place to handle his duties while he's out. And community pressure is sort of like mounting in that borough. They want McElry out. Students have been donned the Quakertown Five. So they have this name now. And community members have raised $140,000 so far to support their legal defense. They want all charges dropped. And of course, the Bucks County Prosecutor's Office is investigating.
So yeah, a lot still to come and to unpack.
Yeah.
Story number two, Cherry.
Yeah. A South Jersey race car driver could soon become the third African-American driver in NASCAR. Hmm. I love this profile of LeVar Scott by the Philadelphia Inquirer. He grew up drag racing in a drag racing family where everybody, aunts, uncles, cousins, all raced. Really cool. Everything sort of centered around his grandfather, Wayne Scott Sr., who opened up an auto repair shop in Carney's Point back in 1978. And LeVar did his first race at just 5 years old on dirt tracks in Pennsylvania and Delaware, where
shaking
he raced.
My head, man. That's crazy.
I know. He raced until he was about 14. And the Inc. even had this photo of him as a kid after winning his very first race. And at 15, LeVar transitioned to asphalt. He moved to North Carolina to make his dream of having a career in racing come true. He got into the NASCAR Drive Diversity Program. And now, 6 years later, he's 22 and he is starting his first year racing full time in the NASCAR O'Reilly Auto Parts Series, the second tier of the sport. And it's so remarkable because there's less than a handful of Black drivers in NASCAR, and there's Bubba Wallace and Rajah Caruth. Those are the two others. And he gives all of his credit for being a driver to his South Jersey and Pennsylvania region roots.
5 years old.
When you I know.
I guess that's typical, man. Whoa. Because mm-hmm. I have a three-year-old, and I'm trying to imagine two years from now putting her in a car and having her. But, you know, I guess that's how the sport works. But it is a nice story. So it sounds like right now he's kind of like in the minor leagues. And
yeah.
He's hoping to move up to the big time. But he's young, 22 years old.
Yeah.
So we'll keep let's remember that name. Let's remember that name.
LeVar Scott.
Okay.
And by the way, I want to also say he's already giving back. He has an agreement with the Urban League. Urban Affairs Coalition.
They sponsor his car.
Yeah. And they have a whole education program to share, you know, racing and education with the next generation. So he's already doing stuff. And he loves Philly. So
what a crazy sport, man.
It's loud. It's really loud.
You've been to a NASCAR race.
Yeah.
I've never been. I don't know how
I mean, I feel like you got to go like once, but it is super loud. You got to have some earplugs.
Did you or did you forget?
I should have had some
earplugs. You paid the price.
Yeah, because I was hearing the rumble even after I left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's gone now, right?
It's gone
now.
Okay, thank goodness.
Okay. Speaking of sounds. One of the most recognizable, widely heard voices in radio today is from Philadelphia, but you probably had no idea. So let's rewind a little bit. If you listen to the radio at all, there's like an 1,000% chance you have heard a commercial that sounds like this.
I got a couple questions. I need answers. What you know about calling top dog? What you know about getting bit by dog? What you know about calling top dog? What you know about getting bit by dog? What you gonna do if that dog chase you? What you gonna do if that dog chase you? That's a serious question. What you gonna do?
That's a serious question. Okay.
What you gonna do? That's the question. What you gonna do?
So that is an advertisement for the personal injury firm Top Dog Law. These ads have become very famous for their strange stream of consciousness rants set over hip hop beats, as you can hear. The voice behind those ads is a guy named Terrell Lucky John. There's a great profile of him in the Washington Post this week. And he is from Philadelphia, and he developed that style, his distinctive style, right here in Philly. He was a club promoter in Philly, and that work led to voiceover work. His first ad was for a gentleman's establishment called a Club Onyx here in Philadelphia. One thing led to another. He now makes, get this, more than $1 million a year doing the Top Dog Law commercials alone.
Yeah, cha-ching, cha-ching. Let me just say that. I remember his Club Onyx ads yelling into the mic. They are legendary.
You remember those ads?
When I first moved here to Philadelphia. He's been doing it for quite a while. I also hear his car commercials as well, telling people, you don't want that Kia, you want a Benz.
Wait, what's that for?
He does advertisements for car for like auto companies.
That's he does.
Yeah, he does those as well. People say he's the DJ Khaled of radio commercials.
That's right.
And
that's
it's pretty cool. And so, you know, but apparently he does quite a few commercials every single week. He's being heard all over the country. Yeah. He's a pretty big deal.
And look, I think it makes a lot of sense. Like if you're in advertising and you're looking for creative input, go to someone who's been like a nightlife promoter, because those people, like, they have to cut through the noise.
Yeah.
Like people who work in clubs, DJs, promoters, like there's a lot of competition in those spaces for people's attention.
Yep.
And you have to have a strong voice and a good shtick to cut through all that.
And
like this guy clearly has it. You can hear that it was honed like in a space like that.
Yep.
And you cannot forget his voice. You cannot miss his voice.
There are viral videos of people just listening to his ads.
Yeah.
That's how, like, and you cannot, whether you like them or you think they're just a little out there,
yeah,
you will not forget them.
Is it better or worse than a John Morgan ad?
I feel like it's kind of better.
I think it's better.
Yeah,
I think it's
better.
Weird. It's wacky. I feel like it's a little gonzo.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate.
And I read that they don't tell him what to say. They trust him.
Yeah, he just gets on the mic and vibes.
And goes for it. Yeah. I mean,
what are you going to do if you get bit by a dog?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
You go call top dog.
Yeah, you will.
Look, we even repeating it because it's so memorable.
Maybe, should he cut a promo for Studio 2?
He would get, people would know us then because he's so good. But
all right,
how much does he cost?
Anyone have $1 million lying around? I'm looking at producer Debbie Builder. You got $1 million?
They're like, no.
Nah, she says no. Al Banks engineer? No.
No, nothing? No.
How about $500,000, guys? Okay, we'll work on it. After the show, we'll talk about it.
So we're going to have a serious show today.
Serious show today. We're talking about artificial intelligence and war. This topic has gotten a lot of attention recently because of a debate between the Department of War and the AI company Anthropic. We want to hear your thoughts on this topic. Email studio2@whyy.org and don't go anywhere.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Craig.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Artificial intelligence is rapidly changing the way wars are fought. It's also raising a host of ethical questions about how these weapons should be used.
The U.S. military reportedly used Anthropic's AI model Claude in the strikes in Iran and in Venezuela. But last week, the Pentagon ended its contract with the tech company after a dispute over how the system would be deployed.
Anthropic had clear red lines it did not want Claude to cross. No mass surveillance and fully autonomous weapons without a human in the so-called kill chain. While military officials said they would follow lawful uses, they wouldn't agree to those restrictions. And as a result, Anthropic has been blacklisted as a supply chain threat, and the Pentagon has struck a deal with OpenAI.
So this hour, how is AI reshaping modern warfare? What are the risks this technology poses? If the United States puts on too many safeguards, will we lose the AI arms race? And what could that mean for our security and defense? We have two guests with us to walk us through all of this. We have Paul Shari, Executive Vice President for the Center for a New American Security. He led the working group that drafted the current Pentagon policy on autonomous weapons and is a former Army Ranger. Paul, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Mika Ouyang, a non-resident senior fellow at the Carnegie Mellon Institute for Strategy and Technology and a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber Policy. Welcome, Mika, to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for being here, our listeners. We'd love to hear from you. Here's our question today. Should we restrict how AI can be used in war? Why or why not? Email studio2@whyy.org. You can call 888-477-9499. If you are streaming on YouTube or Facebook, put your comments in the chat.
And Paul and Mika, I mean, when people hear AI and warfare, they picture killer robots. I want to sort of level set by getting an idea of what and how our military is using AI right now versus what is possible. And Paul, can we start with you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we are today in the age of AI warfare. We are seeing artificial intelligence and autonomy being used in a variety of military operations, in the war in Ukraine, in operations that Israel's conducted in Gaza, and then in more recent U.S. military operations in Venezuela and the current strikes in Iran. Now, these are really early days. A lot of what AI is being used for right now is bringing together lots of different information, synthesizing it from different sources, helping to process it to help militaries better understand what's happening on the battlefield, make decisions and do things like, for example, help to build out target lists and help prioritize those for the strikes that the U.S. military is conducting in Iran. U.S. military has hit over 2,000 targets. That means you need a lot of information brought together about all these targets. And that's one of the things that AI is really good at, managing large amounts of information very quickly.
And did you want to add anything, Mika, to how it's being used right now?
Yeah, just to say, you know, I left the department over a year ago, so I don't know exactly what's going on side classified systems. I think there are some places where we, have to be a little bit careful about what the uses are in this moment. But I think Paul's absolutely right. The processing of large amounts of data, especially in the context of targeting, this is actually really important for the military because as you look at these types of conflicts, what you're talking about is the use of very expensive munitions. Missiles are not cheap. And so you want to make sure that you are not hitting the wrong things because you only have so many missiles that you can use at this time. So there are ways in which AI can help us be more efficient and more precise. And I'm sure that that is the priority in the Pentagon right now.
And so what's the evidence that it is helping the military be more efficient and more precise? Because I think people, whether or not they agree with the bombings or not, they want the bombs, they want the munitions to hit the intended targets. So what's the evidence that it's doing what it claims to do in helping humans make better decisions, Paul?
Well, that's a fair question. I think that's the goal is making better decisions, making sure that the military is striking the right targets, not the wrong ones. We don't have a lot of visibility right now on exactly what AI is doing. There's been some public reporting in sort of a general sense that Anthropic's model Claude has been integrated into the military's Maven smart system that's used to process information, and that's being used to support analyzing information for strikes, helping to prioritize, build information for the military as they're processing strikes. But the sort of like very granular, well, what exactly is it being used for? How does it compare to what the military was doing before? And is it better than humans? Like, what's the comparison there? We certainly don't have that information publicly to make a good assessment on to what extent it's actually helping.
And I know, again, there's the shroud of classification and secrecy here, but like when we talk about synthesizing data, my sense is we're not just talking about, putting a lot of intelligence reports together and saying, what do these reports say? But also like visual data as well, maybe things that are like a little less that like it would be very, very, very hard for humans to do. Is that right, Mika? Like it's been able to take inputs that are not just text inputs.
That's absolutely right. When you think about the military, they have this vast system of what they call ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. And that does not mean, I think, the way that people are worried about surveillance in this fight between Anthropic and the department, but it means things like satellite imagery overlaid with things like, mapping information to be able to identify the difference between what's a military headquarters and what's a civilian building. And it's that type of thing that really matters. It may be able to help you identify, cell phones of particular high value targets, things like that, so that you are really focusing on those things that have military necessity. And that's one of the core principles for the military when fighting a war like this, is they're trying to focus on targets with military necessity. That's, like that have military value for them. And you want to make sure that you are discriminating between those military and civilian targets.
Yeah, interesting. And I want to talk about this Anthropic situation where they had these bright red lines, and one of them was that the technology would not be used in autonomous weapons and that it would not be used for mass surveillance of Americans. But the Pentagon would not agree to that. I'm trying to get a better understanding. What is this technology capable of doing right now, such that those red lines had to be established? And Paul, do we have any ideas of, even though we may not be using it that way at this point, what could it be used for?
Sure. So Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei has articulated sort of what his concerns are behind these two uses: one, domestic mass surveillance, and two, fully autonomous weapons. And they're a little bit different concerns, actually. Now, the concerns with mass surveillance is that AI has the ability to bring together all of this information that might, in some cases, even be publicly available through commercial means in like terms of commercially available bulk data. That it's just not, it's not feasible for humans to process all this information. And AI could bring that together, information on geolocation data for people or internet usage, for example, and that could enable a sort of scale of government surveillance that's not feasible with humans. And it's not hypothetical. We're actually seeing China deploy this internally in their country and building this very dystopian sort of techno-authoritarian state. And that's not a model that we want to import here into the United States. Now, the autonomous weapons concern is a little bit more hypothetical right now, in that both Anthropic and the Department of War said that that's not an immediate issue, but the Pentagon wants to have the flexibility to maybe deploy fully autonomous weapons down the road, and Anthropic said they're not comfortable with that.
Mm. Yeah. Let's just talk about what we mean when we say autonomous weapons.
Yeah.
So, Mika, what type of weapon would theoretically qualify as an autonomous weapon? What sort of like advancement, what leap goes from weapon to autonomous weapon? What line do you have to cross there?
Yeah, so let me just come back to this question on autonomous weapons. Just before we get to the weapons themselves, let's talk a little bit about the scenarios, because I think that when people are thinking about these scenarios of autonomous, right, drone swarms and the killer robots, they have a particular scenario in mind, and I think that's different than the scenario that the military is thinking about for when we talk about autonomous weapons. And I think we are worried about drone swarms going against groups of people on the ground. And we've seen that over the decades and decades of counterterrorism, right? We've seen that video imagery. We have a sense of what that's like. And I think people are rightly worried about that, given the intelligence challenges that there are in sorting out civilians, combatants from non-combatants that are human beings on the ground. But what we're talking about, what the Pentagon is talking about when we're talking about autonomous weapons, when we come back to nation-state conflicts, when we're talking about the US versus Iran, the US versus China, the US versus Russia, we're talking about countries that have advanced weapons that are missiles, and in some cases hypersonic missiles, that can move faster than the human ability to make a decision about whether or not to target those things or not.
Yeah.
And so we've seen in Israel these autonomous systems that are missile defense systems that make decisions about which missiles we are going to strike down and which ones we are not going to strike down, based on AI calculation that's very different from humans, because if you ask a human to make those decisions, you're too late to be able to do the defense that's necessary. And so when we think about autonomous weapons, when we talk about the military having these advanced algorithms that make decisions about this is in fact an inbound target that's going to cause damage, we have to hit it. This is a target that's inbound that may fall in a place that's harmless, we're going to let it go. Mm. This is a civilian airliner based on speed and profile. That is the type of thing where you have to make decisions at faster than human scale.
So, but does a weapon become autonomous, by definition, when it can and is programmed to fire any type of munition, whether it's in defense or offense, without a human ever being involved? Is that when we cross the Rubicon into autonomous, or is there another definition?
Yeah, I think that there are different definitions of autonomous. And so that's part of the challenge here is you have a drone that can fly by itself that doesn't have a human in it. That is an autonomous system. The decision to fire may be controlled by a human sitting back in a control center somewhere else around the world. That doesn't mean the weapon itself is autonomous. It does mean that the device is autonomous in a navigation sense. So I think that we have to be really careful about what people mean by autonomous weapon systems and what the decision is that's being made here by the machine as opposed to the human.
Yeah, let's bring in a caller. And by the way, our question of the day is, should we restrict how AI can be used in war? Why or why not? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We have Mary from Philadelphia on the line with a thought on this. Mary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. My comment is that the use of AI in warfare is very concerning to me, because of the fact that AI can learn on its own. It can start out with instructions from a human the way a computer would, but it is capable of independent learning. Now, you might say, someone fires an AI drone. That drone will only be in the air seconds, minutes. How much can it learn in seconds or minutes? But if you are going to create an AI directed hovering device, a lethal hovering device, with the idea that you're going to tell it, now is the time we want you to act, it may be in the air long enough to start making up its own mind about where it should act, how it should act, when it should act. The whole ability of AI to do independent learning presents a whole new possible field of you know, an AI device of that nature could even start a war where none exists.
Let's get some response. That's Mary from Philadelphia. Paul, I want to get your thoughts because that is one of the biggest fears I think many people have about artificial intelligence. Could, you know, this happen? I mean, is this even possible with what we know about the capabilities at this point? And could we move in that direction, Paul?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, what we're getting at with Mary's comment and the earlier question about the terminology with autonomous weapons is these terms are so slippery.
Yeah.
AI, autonomy, learning, you know, they're used, but sometimes they mean different things. People are talking about different kinds of systems and applications. And I think there's a really important distinction between a machine that uses machine learning that's trained on data. For example, militaries have a database of what tanks look like, enemy tanks, and they train an image classifier to identify those tanks. Now that uses machine learning, but it's not using it in real time on the battlefield. It's trained in advance in peacetime on this data set versus what Mary's describing, which would be a whole other set of problems would open up if you had an AI system that was actually learning from feedback on the battlefield in real time without human involvement. Now, that's actually not the kind of AI that's deployed today. It's possible we get there down the road, and that would really open up a whole different set of risks.
Yeah, and anything to add there, Mika, because I think that's the fear. That's the thing people see in movies that, you know, the AI is going to somehow become self-aware and start making moves, overriding human intervention, human decisions, and they're wondering if this AI that we're looking at now, is there a way to stop that and draw a bright red line in the sand?
Yeah, so just to back to Mary's point about, as Paul described it, right, the machine that's actually learning on the battlefield, I think we're a long way away from that, in large part because when you think about the massive data centers that are required to power that learning, it's hard to put that kind of data center on a drone that's actually out there on the battlefield, right? There's a lot of compute that has to happen. And to Paul's point, like, you've really got to train these things in advance. It also means that those systems have to maintain connectivity with the original data set, training model, all of the rest of that. You know, where how we get to a more lightweight model that's learning on the learning on the fly, I think, is a little bit tougher. But to the question of, like, what is the AI learning towards? This is where the technology is in a pretty immature state. And as the Department of Defense is working with these companies, this is part of trying to train the model to do the things that you intend it to do and not the things that you don't want it to do. And it's really important that they are thinking through what are the core values of that AI, because there's a really big difference in asking the AI to inflict maximum damage on the enemy versus maximum protection of your forces or your civilians.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Maximum damage on the enemy might mean you take out 97% of the incoming missiles. Maximum protection of your forces or your civilians might mean that you only take out 70% of the missiles because you know 30% of them are going to fall harmlessly and you don't actually need to use your weapons against those. And so, like, those are really important questions about what you are asking your AI system to optimize for.
Interesting.
And if you are asking an AI system to optimize for defense, which I think most people would kind of consider, at least lay people would consider to be like a good use, a best case use. If you're asking it to optimize for defense, why wouldn't the system at some point conclude that the best defense is a good offense and, like, you know, neutralize the threat before it can launch missiles, Paul? Like, is that how do you go about designing a system that will kind of do only what you intend it to do in a first order way and never move to that second order?
Well, I guess I think that really points to the importance of still having humans involved, that, you know, having humans involved to be setting what the values are, what the objectives are of the system, as Mankiw was saying, but then also in supervising its operation, in testing it in advance, putting it in different environments, but acknowledging this reality of we don't know where the next war is going to be fought. War is an inherently adversarial environment. The enemy is going to try to do things that are clever to disrupt our AI systems, to trick them, to manipulate them. And we've seen that AI systems are subject to those kinds of manipulations. They can be fooled in various ways. And so that's one of the reasons why, a sort of future where militaries just unleash these AIs and then there's no human involvement, I think it's probably not realistic. There are going to be circumstances where militaries do have to delegate some autonomy to the machine to be effective because of the need to move very quickly or because perhaps the communications link is being jammed to some drone, you need to carry out an operation. But there's still going to be a lot of value in having humans involved in these decisions.
Huh. Yeah. Charles says industry standard will say the best ethical decision is human in the loop integration. And Mika, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the type of guardrails that you would set to sort of make sure that that is the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference between hard-coded guardrails, and I do think that it's important that the military have some. I don't think that they're the same as the ones that you have in the civilian world, because the military's mm-hmm. mission is inherently one that is lethal, and in the civilian world, you don't want that. But I do think it's important that the military thinks about what there is, and there are some rules and principles for the military when it comes to lawfare, to law, and we talk about the laws of armed conflict. We talk about necessity, proportionality, discrimination. And these may not be hard-coded guardrails, but maybe prompts to the user to say, what is the valid military target here? What is the nature of that military target? Hey, we have some uncertainty about whether or not this target is military or civilian. Do you want to proceed? There are ways in which you may not have to have it hard-coded, but you do need the system to prompt for those things. You also want some things like prompting it to make sure that it's not going to commit fratricide on your own forces, right? We don't want any friendly fire incidents happening there. How do you make sure that that doesn't happen? And then also, and this is the thing that I worry about from my time in the Pentagon with cybersecurity, is how do you ensure that these systems aren't misused by insiders in ways that could compromise sensitive information, that could undermine the goals of the military? And there are guardrails that are, I think, necessary for that to make sure that you don't have someone misusing the system from within in ways unintended by the leadership. And we've seen examples of insiders misusing that information in ways that leak and are problematic, and you want to make sure that you have really strong oversight controls on that.
How is that different than insiders getting nuclear intelligence and leaking it to an enemy? Is there something inherently different about AI technology that makes that type of insider leak or misuse potentially more harmful, Mika?
Yeah, as we're looking at the development of what they call agentic AI, where people are programming AI to do things on its own and don't really understand how the AI goes about doing it, we've seen examples of AI, you ask it to do something and you don't have the permission to do the thing. And the AI goes ahead and does what they call privilege escalation. It automatically makes you a systems administrator to give you more access to information than you would have had otherwise, and then is able to solve the problem. That in the real world with humans is not okay. The other thing that we've seen are these agents that like to talk to other agents and other people's agents about this. And we don't necessarily know what kind of information is being shared agent to agent and whether or not there's sensitive information leaking out in those communications that are invisible to humans. And that is a very big security concern for the military, but frankly, for any enterprise that has sensitive information that it wants to protect for a variety of reasons. Mm.
Before we get to a break, real quick, wanted to bring in a caller. This is Dan from Winmore Online 2. Dan, we're about to hit a break in a little over a minute, but if you wouldn't mind, I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, we already have an example of the importance of human intervention. Russian Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov in September 1983 prevented a potential nuclear war by identifying satellite warnings of incoming missiles as a false alarm and refused to launch a retaliatory response despite the rules of engagement. And today, AI systems are far more advanced than that, but we're still warned about hallucinations in the system. And besides hallucinations, the systems can make mistakes based on how they're trained. Mm. So there's an example.
Yeah, yeah, of needing to have humans in the loop. And actually, on the other side of this break, I'll tease this. I think, Paul, you had a story from your time in the service that you told our producer, Debbie Builder, about how that maybe could illustrate some of the dangers of using AI on the sort of the battlefront. And why human judgment might be needed. And that is exactly what Dan was talking about there. So we're not going to get to that story right now. I'm just going to tease it as we head into the break. And want to remind you that you can call 888-477-9499 if you want to comment on this conversation about AI and warfare. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, put your comments in the chat.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This hour, we're talking about how artificial intelligence is changing warfare and supercharging an AI arms race and the serious ethical questions about how these systems will be used, potentially for fully autonomous weapons and mass surveillance.
Let me reintroduce our guests. Paul Shari is Executive Vice President for the Center for a New American Security. He led the working group that drafted the current Pentagon policy on autonomous weapons and is a former Army Ranger. He's also the author of a book, For Battlegrounds. And Mika Ouyang is a non-resident senior fellow at the Carnegie Mellon Institute for Strategy and Technology and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber Policy.
Yeah, and we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. Our question of the day, should we restrict how AI can be used in war? Why or why not? Also, if you have general questions about how AI is being employed in warfare, you can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, share the video, but also put your comments in the chat.
So, Paul, I teased this before the break. You've been on the battlefront and you've had scenarios where you had to identify combatants and figure out whether or not, you know, to kill them. And you told our producer, Debbie Builder, a story from your time, I believe, in Afghanistan. And I was hopeful that you could, you know, tell us that story, but also what you take away from it.
Sure, absolutely. So we've been talking about AI sort of in the context of, well, what if AI makes mistakes and gets something wrong? But there's another dimension of, what if AI gets something wrong from a moral dimension? And obviously these life and death decisions in war have huge moral consequences. There was an incident when I was an Army Ranger. I was part of a sniper team that was up on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And we infiltrated at night, and we were discovered very early in the morning when the sun came up. And they sent a little girl to scout out our position. She was about 5 or 6. She had a couple goats in tow, I think as cover, that she was, you know, maybe herding goats, but it was pretty clear that she was there to look at us. And she heard, we heard the chirping of what we later realized was a radio that she had with her. So she walked this circle around us, and she stared at us, and we stared at her, and she laughed. And not long after, some Taliban fighters came to attack us. So we took care of them, and then we left afterwards, after the gunfight. And we were talking afterwards about how we deal with a similar situation like this. And I will tell you that no one suggested the idea of shooting a little girl. Like, that was not a topic that came up. Now, what's interesting is that under the law of war, she was scouting for the enemy. Yep. The law of war does not set an age for combatants. And so under the law of war, she was operating as a combatant, and killing her would have been lawful under the law of war. Now, I would argue that would be morally wrong, certainly not consistent with the values that I was raised with as an American. Nobody else, you know, my team had suggested something like that. But it raises the question of, if you programmed a robot to perfectly comply with the law of war, you know, it would have killed this little girl. And so how would a robot know the difference between what is legal and what's right? Yeah. And how would you program that in? And so, you know, that is another dimension to this challenge that comes up. And it's not the same stakes as Stanislav Petrov deciding to avert nuclear war. We're grateful for the decision that he made. But these smaller life and death decisions do happen in war, And they sure mean an enormous amount to the people affected by them.
Yeah. David Began on YouTube says, fully autonomous lethal systems raise profound moral questions. Should machines ever decide to take a human life? Many ethicists, legal scholars, and faith leaders argue no. And Zachary on YouTube says, who is liable when AI makes a mistake and accidentally kills a civilian or multiple civilians? AI frequently hallucinates, not a problem when it misrepresents an image, big problem when it kills. And so, Mika, I want to bring you in and try to help us deal with some of the ethics of this, because, Paul lays out this whole scenario. There's a difference between what is legal there versus what is right. And you know, humans make mistakes, but AI does too. So who is responsible? Like, how do we think through the possibility of us, you know, using AI that makes a mistake and it's lethal?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And I think people want to blame the machine, but really, ultimately, it is the employing military that is responsible for the consequences of that. And so it doesn't matter if it's a human in the loop that accidentally kills a civilian or an AI-driven decision. Then ultimately, the U.S. military would still be responsible. And in previous years, what you've seen is the military would pay a condolence payment to the family as an acknowledgement that we had made a mistake. And then they try to do better, right? They try to be more precise. They try to improve. In the fog of war, it is very unfortunate and it is tragic. But there are times when mistakes will happen, and that is ultimately the responsibility of the military that uses the tool. But I think it is a really important question, because machines don't have that same human sympathy that human forces have. And I think that in some cases that's really good, right? Like I'm out here on the West Coast, and you take a Waymo and it drives and it never gets annoyed if it gets cut off. It never gets annoyed at traffic. It just does its thing. The machine doesn't have a human emotional reaction, right? The machine in wartime is not going to get hot and go to overkill based on what the guidelines are. At the same time, it may not have the sympathy and the moral judgment as Paul's team did when it comes to identifying a combatant or not and make a decision that it doesn't have to make on that human sympathy. And so there are pluses and minuses to having that machine make the decision. Sometimes human emotions can get manipulated on the battlefield to their detriment as well. So it's a really complicated decision. And ultimately, I do think the humans want to maintain control of the machines to be able to control escalation, decide when enough is enough.
Yeah.
But I think we are in for some complicated and painful situations as we work through all this.
And I had a quick follow-up for you, Paul, because there's this tension between, you know, using AI in warfare to save lives, but also, you know, there's a possibility that AI could make warfare more deadly. And you told our producer that there was an example in the past where we brought, you know, technology into warfare that we thought would make things easier and save lives, but it did the exact opposite. Could you talk about that example?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a couple examples on either side of this, right? So one way in which we saw technology make warfare much more violent is the origin of the machine gun, which actually come out of an invention called the Gatling gun that Richard Gatling invented after the American Civil War, where he wanted to reduce suffering in war. And his goal was to reduce the number of soldiers that were needed on the battlefield. And what the Gatling gun did was dramatically increase the firepower that individual soldiers could unleash in the battlefield. Well, when then you fast forward to World War I, we saw that actually made the battlefield far more deadly and led to an entire generation of European men that were killed on the battlefield in World War I. And so that's, you know, that's an area where, wow, that turned out pretty terribly. But on the flip side, I want to point to where we see right now bombing campaigns by the U.S. military using precision-guided weapons that are very precisely hitting thousands of targets in Iran. And that is in stark contrast to the area bombing that nations conducted in World War II, where whole cities were demolished in Europe and Asia. So that's an area where technology has made warfare much more precise and humane and has dramatically reduced civilian casualties. So a lot of it's about, like, how do we use this technology? How are we going to employ it? And how do we make sure that we do so that makes war more precise and more humane, but doesn't lose our humanity in the process?
Interesting comment from John, who says, what if AI does a better job than humans? Humans have been killing each other for all sorts of reasons for as long as we've existed. Are humans really the best judge of the success or failure of AI on the battlefield? Could AI theoretically conclude that war is a bad idea and just stop? A couple more comments I want to read, because we really haven't gotten to the real politic of all this. Mm-hmm. Maggie from Wilmington says, in warfare, there are no fixed rules. Every available means must be used. I support the use of AI as a tool in war. Stuart says, as long as humans have existed, each military has used its best technology to beat its opposition. We should not only use AI, we should fund AI in order to both beat our enemies better and defend ourselves better. And that brings up the obvious question, Mika, of if we don't do this, the we being the U.S. mm-hmm. here, do we just cede the future to another country, perhaps a country that is intent on doing more harm? And, you know, do we really have a choice? And that's what it gets to, really, Mika. Do we really have a choice when it comes to investing in AI and deploying it in war? Or is it a false choice because basically we have to do it at least as deterrence?
Yeah, I think that this is where, you know, we have to start talking about China, because China is also developing these AI models, and that we have this big technology competition happening between the US and China on like who's got the best AI models, who's being able to use it well for their military. And as AI helps you move more quickly in warfare, if we don't actually enable our warfighters to use it, to be more efficient, to be able to respond more quickly and effectively and precisely to what our adversaries are doing, we will find ourselves really behind. Now, there are questions about how China would use this, and I think this comes back to a lot of dialogue that we need to be having about rules of engagement, protection of civilians, technology diffusion, and crisis communications. And we are not in that place right now, but I think that it would be leaving our military, who's protecting Americans, at a disadvantage if we don't think about how we use this technology in ways that are effective. Now, I do think that there are people who hope that the AI, when it's learning, would realize that maybe warfare is not the best way to go forward. And for many of your older listeners, maybe they've seen the movie War Games, where ultimately the AI concludes the only way to win is not to play. I think we haven't seen that yet from AI models in War Games. But it's entirely possible that they may do that on their own. And we talk about, you know, AI and its ability to be self-protective. I think there are questions of like, would the AI, in fact, prioritize the preservation of data centers over the preservation of humans? And those are things that we want to make sure that we understand with the AI as we are moving forward in this technology.
On that point, actually, because you mentioned War Games, one of our YouTubers, Ian Switaj 845, was asking you folks to discuss some of the reports in the past week of AI agents being quick to recommend nuclear strikes in war games. So the opposite, right? It's ramping up its aggression as opposed to, you know, going through the logic of we shouldn't do war at all. Is there any way at this point, Paul, to determine whether or not AI will lead us toward a more aggressive path or a de-escalation path in general? Or is it just way too early to say?
No, I don't think that we're at the point where we could say right now this is the direction AI is heading. Look, anyone that's interacted with a large language model knows they can do some strange things based on how they're prompted. They tend not just to do the engaging hallucinations, or basically making things up, but has this tendency towards sycophancy, towards agreeing with anything that you say. And then if you push back on them and say, well, you know, let me give me a counter argument. Oh, yes, you're right. Let me do that. And so you're going to get these weird biases. I mean, I'd seen that reporting. It's quite fascinating. But I think really what that gets to is this underlying question of what is the AI trained to do? What's the data set that it's trained on? And then what are the objectives that it's given? And that's going to drive different kinds of behavior. But for some of these large language models, their behavior is so complex that it's not a rule-based system. It's not like, you know, a more traditional piece of computer programming that, you know, says, oh, okay, if this, then do this. It's this massive neural network with billions of connections. And so there is some process afterwards. We have to kind of tease out the performance of the AI, put it into different settings, try to figure out, okay, how is it going to behave?
Yeah.
And that's going to be really important as our AI systems become even more sophisticated and capable going forward.
And by the way, we had a few people asking about the bombing of a girls' school in southern Iran. Any idea whether AI was involved in that, Mika?
Hard to know, but I would just say that humans make those mistakes too. And it's based on the quality of the underlying intelligence that you have. Right, we saw in the 90s during the U.S. bombings of in Bosnia, right, they accidentally hit the Chinese embassy there. There are places where humans are going to make mistakes. AI may make mistakes, especially as it's powered by intelligence that was collected in traditional ways and processed by humans.
And I wanted to throw this final question. We only have a minute left, but I just wonder, is there any chance that Congress or any body could regulate any of this, or is it just too late because all of this is sort of the genie is sort of out of the bottle? And if each of you could take about 20 seconds to just put a general cap on that, that would be really helpful. And we'll start with you, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, Congress could. They certainly that's part of their job is to pass legislation governing technology and other aspects of American life. I think on some of these issues in particular, like questions surrounding the government using AI for surveillance, Congress really ought to be stepping in here and passing legislation that addresses some of these really challenging issues that right now these really shouldn't be decisions that are left up to private tech companies that are beholden to shareholders and whose motivation is profit. This is what we have a democracy.
And Mika, I wanted to give you like 10, 15 seconds to answer.
Yeah, on the domestic surveillance piece, we already have laws on the books. I helped write them. There are laws that protect Americans from that surveillance. We have the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. There are those things. In some ways, I think it's a little too early for hard-nosed regulation because we're still in a testing phase with the technology.
That's Mika Ouyang, non-resident senior fellow at the Carnegie Mellon Institute. We also heard from Paul Shari, executive vice president for the Center for a New American Security. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks to everybody who called and wrote in for today's show. We appreciate you. And of course, we appreciate our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryant. Mike Schickler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.